Welcome to You Talking to Me, the radio show where your host, Big JD, talks to a different guest every week on a variety of subjects. That's the You Talking to Me show, and now here he is, your host, Big JD.
Welcome to You Talking to Me. I'm your host, Big JD, and today my guest's story reads like the plot of a Hollywood movie. A champion cross-country skier in training for the Winter Olympics, Janine Shepherd's life was irrevocably altered when she was run over by a truck during a training bicycle ride to the Blue Mountains. She was severely injured and faced being bound to a wheelchair for the rest of her life. Taking one difficult step at a time on a long road to recovery, which continues to this day, Janine is now an author and motivational speaker, helping others to deal with similar experiences, struggles, and pain. Janine's books include Never Tell Me Never, of which a movie was made in 1998, Reaching for the Stars, Dare to Fly, and most recently, On My Own Two Feet. Janine Shepherd, welcome to You Talking to Me.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So I'd like to start maybe with a little bit about what your life was like, you know, before your accident, you know, your career as Olympian, what your status was maybe as a skier.
Well, I was in my final year at university at the time. I was studying to be an exercise physiologist. My life had revolved around sport. I'd been an athlete, you know, all my life. I was involved in athletics and triathlons, marathon running, those sorts of things, skiing, then got into cross-country skiing. And at the time, I was in the Australian ski team. I was the top-ranked Australian skier, female skier at the time, and had just been overseas skiing and racing and was making plans to join the Canadian ski team. In fact, Marty Hall, the coach at the time, had invited me to join up with their team in preparation for the 88 Winter Olympics in Calgary. So I came back from traveling in Europe and Canada and the States and was making plans to really pack up and head over and join up with the Canadian team in preparation for the Olympics. I was on top of the world.
Then you're doing some training, your bicycle ride?
Yeah. Well, we were going on a training bike ride with my fellow teammates from the Australian ski team, and we were riding from Sydney up to what we call the Blue Mountains area. It takes about 6 hours on a bike, and it's a training ride that we did quite regularly. So there were probably about 15 to 20 of us at the time. I was the only girl on the ride. Mm-hmm. So, that was the day that changed my life forever.
And so there was a group of people with you at the time, too.
Yeah, we were in a big pack, and I was actually sick leading up to the ride. I wasn't going to go on the ride because I'd been overtraining and I was pretty tired. But one of my mates from the ski team had travelled from another state, and he was staying with me, and he said, you know, come on, we've got to go on this ride. So I'd had a blood test actually 2 days before, and I was actually waiting for the results of that blood test. So I dragged myself along on this training ride. And we got through most of the ride. We were probably 5.5 hours we'd been riding when I was hit.
You know, before we get into what happened at that time, reliving this, you know, how was it to talk about it for all these years?
Well, strangely enough, you know, when I first started sharing my story, it was totally unplanned because, you know, I wrote the book and then 60 Minutes in Australia did the story on my book and my life. And after that, you know, I was invited to travel around and share my story with companies and other people. And at first it was quite difficult and quite emotional, but I've been doing it for such a long time now that I think I'm just, you know, I can step back, and I think that I really have dealt with so many issues over the years that you know, resulted from the accident. Mm-hmm. And I really am able to live in this present moment. And what I'm doing is drawing on those past experiences to help other people, but I'm not living in that time. I mean, that's the past and that's gone. So, you know, it really isn't difficult at all now.
Right. I guess that's an important thing to, you know, keep in mind, or for others to keep in mind, that, you know, it still is the past, although, you know, what you do does help other people, and keeping it fresh, I guess, in a way it's a good thing for you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not actually keeping the accident fresh. I mean, I've dealt with all those issues. I mean, you know, through my writing and my speaking and all the other things that I've done over the years to come to terms with, you know, my injuries and mm-hmm. the changes in my life, I've dealt with all those things. So I'm not living in the past. I'm living now, and that's what I'm focusing on, what I'm doing now in my life. And I think that's, you know, that is important, because so often we do live in the past and we can't move past those things that have happened to us. And it doesn't have to be an accident. It could be anything that's happened in life, and we get stuck, you know, going over and over in our minds about the things that have happened in life. And it's really, really important that you can, you know, come to terms with those things and move forward. And I've been able to do that. But what I'm doing in my, you know, by sharing my story is drawing on, you know, the things that have helped me and therefore hopefully help other people move forward in their life.
Does it ever bother you to, you know, recap, or are there times maybe not so much when you're doing a motivational speech or something like that, mm-hmm. but maybe you're on your own and maybe you're working on something that you're, you know, you have a speech coming up or something like that. Does it bother you to maybe just even sit by yourself and kind of recap sometimes, or is it that much of the past that it doesn't bother you now?
Yeah, no, it doesn't bother me at all, because I see it as a really positive thing. I see that I've been able to turn something that was potentially tragic into something that was, you know, has become something that's really positive, because I get, you know, so many letters from people that have read my books, and in Australia my books are actually on the school reading list, the school curriculum for high school students. So they actually study my books, and, you know, it's been made into a movie, and, you know, I've had to relive it so many times. When we did the movie, I actually had a large part in that. I did a lot of the writing of the screenplay. I worked with the scriptwriter as well and had a large input, and I was on set every week. And so, you know, it's not often that they, you know, the girl that was the actress who was very well known in Australia, Claudia Carvin, she's an absolutely brilliant actress who played me. She said she's never played anybody that's actually still alive. So that was a strange, you know, interesting experience to go on set and watch my life being acted out. So, no, I see it as a really positive thing, and also my story has evolved over the, you know, over the years, and I've changed, and so I find it really exciting that I'm able to go and share with people and share my journey, particularly what I consider sort of my growth, my spiritual growth and mm-hmm. personal growth with other people, and help them in a positive way. So I only see it as a really positive experience.
And before we get into, like, you know, your accomplishments and recovery from this, so listeners know, you know, basically the story, your neck and back were broken in 6 places, your right arm, mm-hmm. collarbone, 5 ribs fractured, your right leg had been ripped open. You sustained head injuries and massive internal injuries. You had severe lacerations to your abdominal area and lost 5 liters of blood, which that alone is enough to kill somebody, from your own experience and even hearing from others. What goes through somebody's mind when, you know, when you're living this? Because it must have been a lot different story in the beginning for you.
Yeah, well, I actually don't remember the accident. Mm-hmm. I had post-traumatic amnesia, but that's when something's so painful that the body just blocks it out. But right. I actually had a near-death experience, so I know that the reason I didn't remember my accident is that I'd already left my body by then anyway. And for me, it was a matter of, you know, deciding whether I was going to come back again. It's a really difficult thing to talk about. Mm-hmm. That is a difficult thing to talk about, because it's difficult for me to actually try to put into words what that experience was like.
Right.
And, you know, all I can say to people is it was like an incredible struggle. Mm-hmm. And I was in such an enormous amount of pain that, to me, it was the decision of whether I went back into this body that was so badly broken, or whether I, you know, just let go. And believe me, I really wanted to let go. Mm-hmm. I knew that if I did, that I would be out of this pain forever, and that was a good thing. But there was this dialogue, and that's the only way I can describe it, really. And for the first 10 days, I have actually no recollection of the accident itself or what was happening to me. Because from the scene of the accident, when they picked me up, they flew me by a rescue helicopter down to a large spinal unit in Sydney. I don't remember that. I don't remember lying in the intensive care. But I do remember a presence of some sort, and that was, I believe, my father was sitting next to my bed for that first 10 days holding my hand, and I think that was my lifeline. And I really think that it was his strength and his will, along with the rest of my family and people that were dear to me, that really kept me here. And of course, it was after about day 10 when it was as if the lights went on.
Right.
And I opened my eyes and saw people looking down at me for the first time. And that was really my first recollection. So up until then, you know, I don't remember what was going on. From my parents' point of view, of course, it was a totally different story. Nobody thought that I was going to survive the accident. Nobody thought I was going to survive the helicopter flight. Mm-hmm. When my parents arrived at the hospital, they told them that, you know, that I wouldn't survive. And it was just minute by minute and day by day. So it was, you know, incredibly difficult time for those people that were close to me.
So at some point, I guess, you would be under the understanding that you would recover. But I mean, maybe not recover properly. What went through your mind at that time? Was it right away that you realized that, you know, you're not going to let anything stop you from whatever type of recovery that you could make? Or did that come later that you...
In the beginning, they said to my parents not to tell me anything because I had so many injuries that they feared that if they told me the extent of my injuries, I would probably give up. And mm-hmm. I think that they were probably right. So it was, they used to feed me information on a need-to-know basis. They thought when I was ready to find out, you know, what injuries or what other injuries I had, that I would probably ask, which is what happened. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, I didn't understand exactly the extent of my injuries. And when I first found out that I'd broken, you know, my back, I think that was the first thing I found out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was then on morphine and... You know, I sort of went, oh, okay, broke my back, oh, great, and had no understanding. You know, I thought, oh, yeah, okay, but hold on, if people break their backs, that means they don't walk again. Oh, yeah, but that's not me. And, you know, having been an athlete and an elite athlete and my whole life revolved around sport, I just, you know, I didn't believe it. I thought I'll just close my eyes and wake up and, oh, maybe I'll be back at home. But, you know, days went on, of course, and I wasn't. And then I'd find out that something else was wrong. And then they did, you know, then they did some tests on me and they, you know, started pricking me with pins. And I realized that, oh, gosh, I don't have any feeling from the waist down. And that was a bit strange, but still really didn't have any understanding of what was going on around me. And then, of course, I think the real moment for me that, you know, things were a lot worse than I thought was when, you know, they did a test on my back called a myelogram, where they put a big needle in my spinal cord and took out all the cerebrospinal fluid and they injected dye in and strapped it to a bed and take a picture of your back. And that's when they discovered that, you know, that I had a blockage in my spinal cord at the L1 level. It was completely crushed. Mm-hmm. So the broken neck was stable, and as long as I was still, that was okay. But the vertebrae L1 was completely crushed. Just there was nothing left of it anymore. They said to my mother, it's as if you trod on a peanut and crushed it into thousands of pieces. That's what my back looked like. And
wow.
So that was the time when they really sat us down. I was lying flat on my back in the spinal ward. But, you know, mum and dad, they sat them down and said, you know, we're going to have to operate. If we don't operate, she's going to be in a wheelchair for the rest of her life. And if we do operate, there's a very small chance that she might walk again. But it's delicate spinal surgery and there are no guarantees. So I think that was, for me, you know, a pretty scary moment that, wow, this is a lot worse than I could have thought.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we went for the operation and they spent 6 hours operating on my back. They had what's called an anterior decompression laminectomy, where they took out two of my broken ribs and they used that and the bone that they picked out of my spinal cord to make a makeshift vertebrae, and they jammed it back in between T12 and L2, and then used the other broken rib as a splinter on either side, and then they spent an hour just stitching me up, and then I woke up again in intensive care, and at this stage the doctors thought that the operation had been successful because they'd made a solid fusion. And they were pretty excited because at this point I had a little bit of movement in one of my big toes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I thought, great, great, because I'm going to the Olympics. But, you know, I had no idea, absolutely no idea what lay ahead of me at that
right.
stage. I still thought that, yeah, okay, but people break their necks and backs and they don't walk. But no, that's not me. You know, that's the sort of thing that happens to somebody else. I just couldn't get my mind around it. I don't know. I just thought I was going to be back out and, you know, back into training again.
I wouldn't think so by a lot of your later accomplishments. Are there any fears instilled in you from the ordeal, such as, you know, being in traffic or cycling or anything like that afterward? You know, is there any fear of doing some of the things you did before or thinking that maybe the same thing would occur again?
No. Okay. I don't think so. Not at all. There were times when, I mean, I have got back on my bike now, mm-hmm. and I mostly ride that on a wind trainer and a porch just because, you know, I'm a mother now and it's a sensible thing to do. If I do go out riding on a road and, you know, I hear a truck behind me, I sort of sometimes, you know, I'll move over and, you know, it's not something that I really love doing. You know, I tend to, as I said, ride on my wind trainer.
Right.
But no, I just think that, you know, what's the point? There's absolutely no purpose in doing that. I mean, you know, I could wrap myself up in cotton wool and live inside, but, you know, I want to live my life. When you've been through something like this and, you know, you've been that close to death, you just know that, you know, life is a gift and you just don't want to waste it.
So is that something you would tell others that maybe had the same thing happen or been involved in some type of accident? You know, they'll say maybe somebody involved in a motorcycle accident that they, you know, they're afraid to ride again or the bicycle or anything like that, that they should overcome that, you think?
Oh, I wouldn't tell them they should do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, it's only what's right for you. And, you know, everybody moves through the healing process at their own rate. And,
right.
you know, if they never got back on a bike, well, that wouldn't be a bad thing either. You know, it's really up to them what they feel comfortable with. But certainly, if it was stopping them from living their life or doing the things that they really want to do, then, you know, that's when I would say, well, maybe it's time to go and talk to someone and maybe work through that. Or maybe there's other things that you can do. But, you know, everybody heals at different rates and everybody has different desires and dreams, and mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the important thing is that you do what's right for you.
Very good. Now about your recovery, your accomplishments and things like that, we'll get into your book shortly, but your pilot's license and your ratings, what's involved in attaining those and you know, how big of a milestone was that for you?
Well, that was huge because when I was when I left hospital, I spent 6 months in the spinal ward, and I left hospital, I was in a wheelchair. I was, you know, at that stage, I was, you know, the prospect of, you know, would I walk again? They said if I did walk again, it would be with calipers and a walking frame. And before I left hospital, the doctor in there had said, basically, Janine, you're going to have to rethink everything you do in your life because you're never going to be able to do the things you did before. So that was fairly devastating news for someone whose life revolved around sport, was going to the Olympics, you know, that's what I was studying, exercise physiology at university. So suddenly everything, every dream that I had came crashing down around me. And, you know, I suffered depression and I went home and I weighed about 5.5 stone. There was nothing. I was just a bag of bones. I was in a wheelchair. I couldn't walk. I was covered in a plaster body cast.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, depression was a big thing for me back then. And I did want to give up. And I knew that, you know, this accident that controlled every part of my life, you know, I just wanted my life back. You know, I didn't want it to control every part of my life. And I knew that if I was going to beat this accident that did, you know, consume every waking moment, I had to find something to replace everything that I'd lost. And that's when an aeroplane flew over and I thought, well, if I can't walk, I might as well fly.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, as crazy as it sounded, you know, much later down the track with, you know, still in the plaster body cast and when I was, you know, with two people holding me up, that's the only way I could stand up. They took me out to the flying school and they carried me down to the airplane and lifted me in. And I, you know, took me flying on this training, what they call a TIFA trial instructional flight.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no use of my legs and, you know, they let me take the controls with my hands and have a little bit of a fly. And I thought, that's it. You know, I can't walk. I'm going to fly. And I just, you know, I knew I had new direction, this new dream, and it sounded crazy to everybody, especially to mum and dad.
Yeah.
And that was really the beginning for me of, you know, finding a new direction in life, and I went home and I thought, that's it, I'm going to learn to fly. I knew I wouldn't pass a medical right then, so I did everything I could. I started this little rehabilitation program where I got a training diary out and I did these little exercises. Mum used to help me lie on the ground and I used to lift my legs a couple of inches. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, it wasn't much, but it was better than nothing. And as long as I lifted them one more time than the day before, that was great. And I practiced my walking and, months and months of, learning to walk. Firstly, two people holding me up, and then I got to the point where I could walk with one person holding me up. Then I'd walk between pieces of furniture around the house as long as they weren't too far apart. And then I used to walk around holding onto the walls. And then I got to the point where I got my big plaster cast removed and they put a big steel brace on. They said I'd have to wear that for another 3 months. And then, of course, I went for a medical, a pilot's medical. And, that was... The doctor took one look at me walking in, mum holding me up, me, skinny little thing, limping in with a big brace on, and thought, my goodness, what have we got here? And anyway, it's a long, long story, but they passed me for my pilot's medical. I had to go and have lots of tests, and I had to get letters from my surgeon, and they sent it down to the Civil Aviation Safety Authority, and they did pass me. And then I went on and... started my flying lessons at this flying school where all these, young guys that wanted to be airline pilots, and then there was little old me who, was just learning to walk and, in a big brace, and, there was, the looks from people like, oh, my goodness, what's she doing here? She doesn't belong here.
Right.
And having to just try to stay focused that, I could do this. And at the same time, I was having lots of operations because I couldn't... I had what's very common to spinal patients, which is called claw toes. So my toes were sort of clawed and I couldn't get my feet in shoes, and I still can't stand on my toes. They did some tendon transfers to try and help me walk. Mm-hmm. They cut the tendons and pinned all my toes straight. I had, constant operations, and I was on medication. I was in and out of hospital constantly. And all this time I was taking flying lessons. Little things that just kept me going, lessons that just kept me focused. And
it doesn't sound like little things. I mean, it's hard to believe that you were going through so much of the things that you're going through, in and out of the hospital, that while you were actually doing this, it sounds like something that somebody would do long after you were finished with the hospital and the operations. And then you went on to get your aerobatics instructor license, is that?
Yeah, I went on, I got my pilot's license, I got what's called my restricted license, and then I learned to navigate, and I flew some people around, some friends of mine actually, around Australia, and got my unrestricted license, and then I ended up getting my commercial pilot's license, my twin engine rating,
wow,
my instructor rating, my aerobatics rating, and, within sort of 2 years after my accident, I was an aerobatics flying instructor at Bankstown Airport in Sydney.
That's...
And all the time, I'm actually a partial paraplegic, so I'm a paraplegic that is walking. So, it was a huge accomplishment for me.
That is incredible. How about other personal achievements or awards and things like that? Are there other things that you would rate up there with, getting your pilot's license and things, or are there some other?
Well, there's definitely something that I would rate way, way above getting my pilot's license, and that's becoming a mum.
Uh-huh.
Because the doctors didn't think I'd ever have children because of my internal injuries. And, I went on and had three children, so
great.
I think that's my greatest accomplishment.
That's fantastic, yes.
Yeah.
And you're a motivational speaker.
Yeah, I really don't like that term, motivational speaker, because I believe that motivation can only come from within. So it's sort of a strange one. I like to say, well, for lack of a better word, yeah, people say that's what I am, a motivational speaker, but I call myself a storyteller because, well, I share my story.
Uh-huh.
And, I can inspire other people, and then they have to find the motivation within. So maybe I'm an inspirational speaker. Maybe that's a better word.
Your speaking engagements, what can one expect from it? You have an incredible client list. You speak everywhere from, obviously, large companies to probably schools and hospitals, healthcare institutions and things?
I do a lot of, well, most of my stuff is within the corporate world, but I also speak to schools and you know, lots of other, as you said, people, groups that are involved or linked some way with, you know, healthcare or disabilities and things like that. So I just, you know, I really, you know, I'm really blessed to be able to do this because, you know, it's a great thing to be able to go out there and feel that you're really making a difference in somebody's life. And that's what I feel like every time I go out and give a talk. I'm sharing my story, I'm sharing my life, and I take people on a journey which covers my life beforehand and the lessons and my philosophy, I guess, that I had as an athlete. And then, of course, I talk about my accident and my flying and what I've learned from that. And the thing is that even though I'm talking to the corporate world, the theme is still the same, whether it's, you know, in a personal level or in a corporate world. We're all going through the same stuff, and the message is still the same.
When you speak to corporations and things like that, the companies, they typically have you there. Is it mainly for motivation and achievements of some, like for the employees or for the company itself?
Well, it depends. You know, sometimes, I mean, I'm heading over to New Zealand next week and speaking to actually a healthcare company over there. And I'm speaking, you know, to their top-level management in that case.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not, yeah, when I say it's motivation, I mean, for a lot of companies, they're going through tough times or, you know, they're going through a lot of change and, you know, they just want people to understand that, you know, how to get the most out of themselves and how to get the most out of their business.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's, you know, what I'm able to do is show people what's possible in life, you know, that we need to not be dictated to by the opinions of others, that, you know, we all have this, you know, incredible power within and hopefully get people to look deeply at their lives to realise that, you know, the potential that we all have inside, not just on a personal level, but of course when it comes to business as well.
And when you're speaking like at educational facilities, healthcare facilities, do you prefer a certain place over another? Do you prefer something, you know, sometimes something on more personal where, you know, the people that you're speaking to might relate more to what happened to you as opposed to just motivating, you know, a business in general? Is there a difference there or is it, do you find it, you know, do you get the same out of no matter where or who it is?
No, I have no preference because, you know, I've been doing this, you know, for a long time now, and I have to say that when I first started speaking, I didn't even know there was such a thing as a speaking circuit. I thought, what? Someone wants me to come and
right.
speak? What's a speaking circuit? The only circuit I knew about was the one you did in the gym. So, you know, I started on the speaking circuit, and I thought, well, okay, this is fine. I'll keep doing this, you know, but when the moment I don't enjoy it, I won't do it anymore. And there isn't one presentation that I've been to that I haven't felt that, yeah, that has been worthwhile, you know, that someone hasn't come up to me and said, you know, thank you, gosh, you've changed the way I look at my life, or, you know, we're going to go out there and, you know, wow, we thought we had problems, but wow, you know, we're going to go out there and really change the way we do things, or, you know, as I said, the way we look at life. So,
right.
And, you know, I just get so much out of it, and it's so enjoyable. I feel, as I said, I feel really blessed because I'm not training people. It's totally different. All I'm doing is sharing a story, and I think people can really relate to that, you know, the humanness of that. I mean, people love, we all love it. We all love to hear other people's stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really fortunate that I'm able to do that.
And something I would say just as fortunate, you being a storyteller, is that you have a number of books. You're an author.
Yes.
One thing right off the top, I noticed from your website, which we'll get into later, some of your contact information if anybody needs to get a hold of you, you're Reaching for the Stars book that couldn't be purchased from your site. Is that still available?
Not at the moment. We are in the process of looking into reprinting that. But that was a small. The other books are all sort of autobiographical, and that's a little motivational book. So
it's one of those
little books that, you know, goes in and comes out. And actually, that happens to be my favorite book. So I really hope that we get that up and going.
I was just curious about that because I noticed on the website, you could purchase all the books right from your website, and I'm like, Maybe it's my web browser's not showing the little buy picture or something. But
No. Actually, it's the one that people write to me a lot and say, you know, I love what you said on page 65. And I quickly get my little copy out and have a look. What was it?
How far apart were your books written?
Well, the first, Never Tell Me Never and Better Fly were, and Reaching for Stars actually, were all about two to three years apart.
Okay.
The last one was only, just came out last year.
Mm-hmm.
They've all sort of mapped this journey.
On My Own Two Feet, that's your most recent.
Yeah, it is.
What kind of information were you able to put into that book that you maybe didn't get to put in the others?
Well, that was the book that wasn't meant to be written, actually.
Oh.
It was incredible because I wrote Never Tell Me Never and I had this incredible feedback and Dare to Fly, you know, people wrote to me and said, well, you didn't finish the story. So Dare to Fly finished and took everyone up to date with what had happened, you know, after the accident, how my life had changed and certain things that happened as a result of writing Never Tell Me Never. Then I wrote my little Reaching for Stars and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, this incredible turnaround came in my life when I say to people that, you know, the hills always keep coming. You know, I always trained on the hills and I say to people that, you know, life is filled with hills. And, you know, Tim, my husband, and I were happily married. And then in 2001, he fell terribly ill. He was a Qantas pilot. And we had no idea what was wrong. And eventually he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And that became, I guess, that chapter of my life that was the one that was never meant to happen. We struggled for years with that, trying to find a diagnosis, and our life just, you know, completely was thrown, you know, into turmoil. It was a nightmare, really.
Mm-hmm.
And from this, you know, perfect, you know, I fought back after my accident. I thought, great, you know, I'd been through that was my difficulty. That was my tough time. I'd been through that. And now it was just going to be smooth sailing. And, you know, I've got my three beautiful kids and we moved down to the country. And of course, Tim fell sick. And this is a story of what happened with that illness and my battle with depression that came as a result from that.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened afterwards. We did eventually separate a few years ago, which was, you know, a really difficult decision I had to make in my life. And as a result, Tim, you know, is alive today and getting his health back and just got his pilot's license back. But as I said, it was a book that wasn't meant to be written, and my publisher really, you know, urged me to write this because she said, you know, that nothing like this has ever been written before, and, you know, depression is such a huge illness. You know, the WHO says it's, you know, the greatest illness of this, this century. So I guess that, you know, that struggle with depression and mental illness was something that I wanted or needed to write about. So that was what On My Own Two Feet was about. So it was probably the most difficult book I had to write.
Does writing come easy for you generally?
Never Tell Me Never came. It just wrote itself.
Right.
And I think the last book was a struggle to write because I wrote most of that while I was actually battling depression myself. I guess, you know, in a way I write that also because people felt that, you know, my life was a fairy tale, that I'd been through my accident. And, you know, I guess I needed to tell people that, you know, life, you know, that this is real. You know, these are the struggles that everybody has every day. Not everybody is an Olympic athlete, but, you know, people go through depression and marriage problems and these everyday problems. And, you know, you can get through this. And
sure, it's easy for anybody to relate to. Even the smallest problems become big problems for people. So,
absolutely. And you know what? There are no fairy tales. You know, there's just life. And you get up every day and you just do the best that you can.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was just another hill.
And
but everything's a learning. Everything's a lesson.
Right. Your first book, Never Tell Me Never, that was made into a movie.
that was made into
That must have been something.
Yeah, that was incredible. That was a fantastic experience. Yeah.
And it was an Australian movie star that starred in the movie, right?
Yeah. Claudia Carvin. Mm-hmm. And she's a really well-known actress and very famous over here. So, you know, it was a great honor to have her playing me. And she did a fantastic job. It's a really great movie.
And did you get to meet her or the cast or anything like that?
Yeah. I was on set every day.
Uh-huh.
And we became great friends. So, yeah, that was a really special bond, and I think that probably helped her, you know, in her portrayal of me as well.
Another great story.
Yeah.
What are some of the important things for people to know, you know, in general, to make their life the best it can be, in your opinion? You know, is there any type of a special one-liner or something maybe that you could kind of use as far as...
Well, if there was going to be one line, I would say learn to love the hills.
Because they're coming.
Yeah, that's right. Because, you know, I always trained on the hills as an athlete. And,
right.
you know, I say the hills are the challenges in our life. And it's the challenges in our life that bring, that's what brings growth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we need to look at every situation as an opportunity to grow and to learn. Because that's what being human is all about.
Right.
So, you know, don't just take on the hills, but learn to love them. Because when you do, then, you know, then they're not... They're not difficulties anymore. You know, that obstacles become opportunities when you look at them like that. You know, that I really believe that life is filled with infinite possibilities, and we all have everything we need to create the life that we want.
The technology of the internet and the web, how have these tools helped you with what you do?
Well, it's, you know, fantastic for me, because when I go, you know, go out and speak, and people, you know, if people want to contact me or, you know, buy my books in Australia, there, you know, my books are available in all the bookshops.
Right.
But for people overseas, for example, you know, I can say, look, go to my website, and, you know, they can access that, or they can contact me through the website. So, it's a wonderful thing. You know, it's a global world. I mean, it's a global environment, and.
Right, it's
and,
made the
and
world.
That's another thing. We're all connected.
Yeah, it's made the world much smaller, I was going to say. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, and that's the thing. You know, and that's a big part of what I say to people too, is that, you know, we are all connected, and I do what I do because, you know, I feel that it's a, you know, responsibility for all of us to give something back and to help other people, and it's something that that we can all do in our own way. You know, we can all make a difference.
How can they purchase your books? How can listeners visit you on the web?
Yeah, they can go to my website, which is www.JeneanShepherd.com.
Okay, and the books can be purchased from there as well as online booksellers. I've seen them on Amazon and so forth.
Yeah,
so
they can.
You really are a clear example of a true miracle, and really appreciate you taking the time to be on You Talking to Me and sharing your story with our listeners.
Thank you for having me. It's been an honor.
Thanks, Jeanine.
Okay, have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
And there you have another edition of You Talking to Me. I'm your host, Big JD. Join me next week for another fantastic guest.
You've been listening to You Talking to Me with Big JD. All shows copyright 2008 Big JD for the OMS Entertainment Group.